This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, November 30th, 2015. I'm Caleb Brown. When you are charged with a crime, the government is typically required to show that you meant to do so. That requirement, known as mens rea, has diminished in its importance at both the state and federal level. At the State Policy Network's annual meeting this year, Robert Ault, president of the Buckeye Institute in Ohio, spoke with me about the importance of criminal intent and how states and Congress can reestablish its proper role in criminal law.
It's very unfortunate. This has been a trend we've noticed in the law for a while. Traditionally, the traditional requirements of the criminal law, you had to commit a bad act, what lawyers call an actus reus, and you had to have a guilty state of mind, what lawyers refer to as mens rea or criminal intent. But we've noticed over the years, both at the congressional level as well as at state levels, more and more crimes are being passed that that either have no criminal intent requirement at all, where you can be convicted for mere accidents, or they have inadequate mens rea requirements or criminal intent requirements.
So what actions or behaviors constitute criminal intent? That is, it's a lower standard?
In the cases where they have inadequate criminal intent requirements, sometimes what's required to get a conviction would not be sufficient, we think, to keep someone who's genuinely trying to follow the law from accidentally violating the law. Or, again, in cases where there's no criminal intent requirement, there you can actually go to jail for a complete accident. And let me give you a story just sort of put it into a real context of something like this that happened. Bobby Unser, I forget if he's 2- or 3-time IndyCar champion, was out at his home in New Mexico, and he went out with a friend snowmobiling one weekend. They went to an area which was very common for people to snowmobile, and they were testing out his new machines. His friend, during the course of the day, he got his snowmobile stuck, and so he got onto Bobby's snowmobile, and they got caught in a ground blizzard. To the point where they literally couldn't see where they were going, and Bobby's snowmobile got stuck. They ended up spending 2 days out in the wilderness in deep snow. Came back. There's actually news footage. They, struggling for their lives to get out. And so once he got out of the hospital, Bobby contacts folks from the wilderness, from the Park Service, trying to find out where it is that his snowmobiles were, where he left them, because he really had no idea the conditions were that terrible out there. After looking at some maps and talking to him and asking questions, and they determined that it seems like, and they weren't even sure, but it seems like he may have wandered into a wilderness area. And this was important because Congress had authorized the Secretary of Agriculture to make rules punishable by up to 6 months in prison, and the Secretary of Agriculture passed a regulation, didn't have to be approved by Congress, which said, quote, "The following are prohibited in a national forest wilderness: possessing or using a motor vehicle, motor boat, or motorized equipment, except as authorized by federal law." Well, what's missing there? There's no criminal intent. It's not that you have to knowingly, recklessly, purposefully operate a motor vehicle. You just have to operate a motor vehicle in a wilderness area. You don't have to know that you're in a wilderness area. You don't have to know that you certainly don't have to know that it's against the law to operate in the wilderness area. So the fact that he may have at some point in blizzard conditions wandered into a wilderness area, that was enough to convict him under this act.
Moreover, you're talking about a federal regulation that does not require any congressional input. You add to that the fact that there's no criminal intent requirement. How many of these kinds of regulations or laws are on the books?
Well, that's a great question. It's a question that I wish that, quite frankly, that Congress would ask. Let's take a step back and even talk about federal laws, federal criminal laws, ones that actually were passed by Congress. In 1998, the ABA, the American Bar Association, created a task force on the federalization of crime. One of these traditional blue ribbon panels with, you know, folks from the prosecutors, defense attorneys, folks from both parties. And they came to a conclusion early on, not only that the federalization of crime was a problem, but they acknowledged that the body of federal criminal law was so large that there's no conveniently accessible complete list of federal crimes. So they had to commission a study. That study found that there were over 3,000 federal crimes at the time. When I was at the Heritage Foundation and the Legal Center, we updated that study in 2007 using the same working with, I believe, the same professor who did the original study. By 2007, the number had jumped to nearly 4,500 crimes, which is roughly an increase of 56.5 crimes per year. Basically, a new crime is passed by Congress every week. But those are the ones that actually make it through Congress. What you asked me about were actually federal criminal regulations, ones that, you know, an agency can go ahead and promulgate without getting any input from Congress. The answer to that is no one knows how many there are. Professor Coffey in New York estimated that the number of regulatory crimes exceed 300,000.
And that's an estimate.
So no one knows for sure. But this actually really, when you begin to have this many crimes, and then you look at the scope of some of these crimes. So many folks listening today may have heard about the Lacey Act. The Lacey Act essentially makes the fish and wildlife laws of every country in the world, makes violation of those laws a violation of U.S. federal law. So if you're doing business in a foreign country, you potentially could face criminal liability here in the United States if you violate the fish and wildlife laws of any country in whatever language they're written in. So when you have that many laws that are incorporated into U.S. federal law, over 4,500 federal criminal laws, over 300,000 regulations, you begin to question the lasting wisdom of the old adage in the law that ignorance of the law is no excuse. This was a principle that is revered in the law, but built up at a time where the number of crimes, particularly felonies, were few. They were knowable. You didn't need to necessarily go and grab a law book to understand, you know, what the potential criminal offenses were that you could be charged with. Now, quite frankly, there are numerous laws that are, again, what we would call in the law malum prohibitum. They're not wrong in and of themselves. It's not like murder, you know, or crimes of violence. They're regulatory offenses. You failed to file the proper paperwork on the proper date. That could be a criminal offense. And there's no way you would know that without actually reading the law or the regulation.
When it comes to criminal intent, what can be done at the state level to establish that here's what we mean when we talk about a person committing a crime? They must have some knowledge that what they're doing is a crime and that they intend to do it.
Well, this is where I'm actually very excited to talk about what we've done in Ohio, because it's something I think that could be replicated in states across the country, and something, quite frankly, that Congress should look at as well. We put in place at the end of last year, Buckeye was instrumental in working with the legislature to pass what I think is the best in the nation default criminal intent requirement in Ohio. And essentially what it does is two things. Number one, if the legislature passes a law and it doesn't have a criminal intent, it has a criminal element in it, but it doesn't have a criminal intent requirement in it. If that makes it through the whole process without having that criminal intent requirement, it's void. The criminal provision itself is entirely voided by the lack of the criminal intent requirement. To my knowledge, no other state and the federal government has nothing like that.
So what does that mean if the criminal element is voided?
The entire criminal provision gets stricken from the law. It doesn't exist. That's no longer part of the law. So you get rid of that crime. It's I think, very strong medicine to the legislature, because if they're sloppy, and quite frankly, a lot of the problems with these, sometimes you've got legislatures that are putting forward legislation that lack adequate criminal intent requirement, and you know sometimes they're doing it to make it easier for the prosecutors, sometimes they're doing it deliberately, but unfortunately, yeah, in the sausage-making process of legislation, sometimes it's just sloppy draftsmanship. And we had, when we were passing, working with the legislature on this particular piece of legislation, there was conversation among the legislators in which they conceded that there was in fact a new sentencing provision that they were passing that didn't do what they thought it was going to do because they hadn't properly drafted the criminal intent requirement. So it happens more than we would like to admit, quite frankly. So this would simply get rid of those crimes. Now, if the crime's already on the books, obviously, you know, we've got a huge body of criminal law in Ohio already, then it would apply a default criminal intent requirement to every element of the offense, not just to the offense as a whole. And this is important because Ohio and some other states, the way the courts interpret the laws, if it has a criminal intent requirement with regard to one part of the law, that may be they've said, well, that's enough. We don't need, if there's multiple parts to the law, we don't need to actually have a criminal intent requirement as to every part. So how this could work out in practice, the example I frequently give, let's say that there is a law on the books and it has a criminal intent requirement. It says that it's unlawful to knowingly possess an artifact taken from a particular type of park, from a national park. Let's say, for instance, grandfather gives grandson an arrowhead, which would be a protected item under this law. But grandfather tells grandson a tall tale of how he got this, that, you know, that he was a friend with this Indian chief who gave it to him many years ago and so forth. When in fact, grandpa pocketed the arrowhead when he was walking through a national park last month, grandson, under this law, would be potentially committing a crime. He knows that he possesses the item. He didn't know that it came from a national park, but courts in Ohio reading that statute would have potentially said he doesn't have to know that it came from a park. There's no criminal intent requirement for that particular part of the law. So this would say we're going to actually require a criminal intent element for every part of the law.
Could Congress do something similar with regulations that don't have criminal intent requirements but are, I mean, separate from the problem of agencies just creating regulations that have criminal penalties attached to them? Could the Congress just say, well, from now on, if there's no criminal, you can't show criminal intent, then that regulation is void as well?
Certainly. I mean, there's a number of things they could do. They could go ahead and put in place a default criminal intent requirement, both for legislation, things that they pass, as well as for regulations. They could put something saying going forward, no regulation shall be valid unless it has a criminal intent requirement, which would be the same thing, essentially voiding anything that doesn't meet that requirement. And what I want to be clear about is this does not tie the legislature's hands with regard to this in the future. The legislature at any time can in passing a law, say that they want it to be strict liability, which is to say that they don't want there to be any criminal intent requirement. Simply committing the act, we're going to say, is enough for you to be convicted.
But they would have to affirmatively assert that
within
the legislation.
They would have to make it clear that that's what they're doing. They couldn't just, by simple omission, by simple failure to put in the criminal intent requirement, have it be treated that way. And the problem is, again, we see a lot of errors of omission. We see a lot of times where, again, in you know sort of the frenetic process of last-minute drafting, you can have something thrown in there and it doesn't have the criminal intent requirement necessary, and then that somehow is treated like that was a strict liability offense, that like that was something where there was no criminal intent required. One of the other things I think that that state legislatures could do, something else that we're working on in Ohio, we're actually doing a complete criminal code revision. Where, you know, this is fairly blue sky, where we're going back, we're taking a look at all the crimes that are on the books and asking a series of serious questions. Should this be a crime? If it still be a crime? Or is it outdated, outmoded, not necessary anymore? If it should be, is it? Have we ratcheted up the penalty to an undue level? You know, over time, there's been a creep. Something will be a misdemeanor. Then we'll do a sentencing enhancement. You know, over time, misdemeanors become felonies. Over time, felonies end up having mandatory minimum sentences. You know, or have, you know, much longer sentences. So we're taking a look and reassessing all of these questions. Which, again, when you look at the expansion both at the state and federal level of criminal laws, you look at something like fraud. At the federal level, no question that there's a role for criminalizing fraud, but in fact, there's, I believe, over 100 federal statutes that regulate fraud. At this point, there's so much duplication. Anytime that there's a new part of the problem is, you know, I think there's a sort of incentive. Anytime there's a new scandal, the most dangerous place to be in Washington is of course between a congressman and a microphone. And what are they going to say when they get to that microphone? They're going to say that they're going to do something about this scandal. And among their favorite tools is, let's create a crime that addresses whatever, you know, this recent scandal is. Well, the fact of the matter is, at this point, we've got crimes on the books that frequently address whatever the underlying malfeasance is. But we'll go ahead and create a new crime so that we can show that we've done something that may address that particular industry, so that we can show that we're being responsive on that. There's plenty of room to go through and remove a lot of the duplication, a lot of the dead wood that's developed both in the federal code as well as at the state level. So I'm pleased that Ohio's taken a leadership role on criminal intent reform, but I also think that, and this is a heavy lift. There was a move in Congress to try and, you know, take a look at the criminal code sometime back. This is something that you're really going to have to get leadership from a member who's got a depth of knowledge on this. But it could be really rewarding in terms of making a leaner criminal code.
Robert Ault is president of the Buckeye Institute in Ohio. Subscribe to this and other podcasts at cato.org.